This is Audible.
Hi, this is Ken Burns, and it's my honor to introduce The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration by Pulitzer Prize winner Isabel Wilkerson. This masterwork chronicles the mass exodus of African Americans from the Jim Crow southern states to the north in search of a better life. Through oral history, thoughtful analysis, and her own experience, Wilkerson tells one of the great untold stories of American history. In this unusually moving and memorable book, she focuses on three specific but symbolic and representative stories. Ida Mae Gladney, a deft snake killer who in the 1930s left servitude and racial bias in Mississippi for the freedoms and opportunities of Chicago. George Starling, a farm worker and union organizer who fled from Florida to Harlem in the 1940s, and Robert Foster, a doctor who departed Louisiana in the 1950s for Los Angeles and eventually became Ray Charles's personal physician. Of the many wide-ranging effects of the migration, perhaps the most profound is how it utterly transformed America, from politics to sports, from literature to music. From food to language, it fueled a wholesale shift, not just in the United States, but also around the world. The book also examines the universality of the immigrant experience. As Wilkerson explains, it speaks to anyone who's ever left a place that they've known all their lives for a place they've never seen. I love this book. It's one of the most memorable books I've ever read and ever owned. Proudly owned, and it seemed to connect with my own sense and feeling about American history. From its very beginning, the United States has had as a principal sub-theme that of race, and in this masterful work, Isabel Wilkerson weaves together the intimate stories of three different people and makes them universal. Anybody interested in the how and why of American history should pick up this wonderful book. Narrator Robin Miles is an inspired casting choice. Her attention to detail, well-researched performance, and nuanced delivery draw you into this wonderfully written work. I present The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration by Isabel Wilkerson.
Brilliance Audio presents the unabridged recording of The Warmth of Other Suns, the epic story of America's great migration by Isabel Wilkerson, performed by Robin Miles. To my mother and to the memory of my father, whose migration made me possible, and to the millions of others like them who dared to act upon their dreams. I was leaving the South to fling myself into the unknown. I was taking a part of the South to transplant in alien soil, to see if it could grow differently, if it could drink of new and cool rains, bend in strange winds, respond to the warmth of other suns, and perhaps to bloom. Richard Wright. Part 1. In the Land of the Forefathers. Our mattresses were made of corn shucks and soft gray Spanish moss that hung from the trees. From the swamps we got soup turtles and baby alligators, and from the woods we got raccoon, rabbit, and possum. Mahalia Jackson, moving on up. Leaving. This land is first and foremost his handiwork. It was he who brought order out of primeval wilderness. Wherever one looks in this land, whatever one sees that is the work of man, was erected by the toiling, straining bodies of blacks. David L. Cohn, God Shakes Creation. They fly from the land that bore them. W. H. Stillwell. 1. Chickasaw County, Mississippi, late October, 1937. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. The night clouds were closing in on the salt licks east of the Oxbow Lakes along the folds in the earth beyond the Yalabusha River. The cotton was at last cleared from the field. Ida May tried now to get the children ready and to gather the clothes and quilts and somehow keep her mind off the churning within her. She had sold off the turkeys and doled out in secret the old stools, the wash pots, the tin tub, the bed pallets. Her husband was settling with Mr. Ed over the worth of a year's labor, and she did not know what would come of it. None of them had been on a train before, not unless you counted the clattering local from Bacon Switch to Okolona, where by the time you sit down, you there, as Ida May put it. None of them had been out of Mississippi, or Chickasaw County for that matter. There was no explaining to little James and Velma the stuffed bags and chaos and all that was at stake, or why they had to put on their shoes and not cry, and bring undue attention from anyone who might happen to see them leaving. Things had to look normal, like any other time they might ride into town, which was rare enough to begin with. Velma was 6. She sat with her ankles crossed and 3 braids in her hair and did what she was told. James was too little to understand. He was 3. He was upset at the commotion. "Hold still now, James. Let me put your shoes on," Ida May told him. James wriggled and kicked. He did not like shoes. He ran free in the field. What were these things? He did not like them on his feet. So Ida May let him go barefoot. Miss Theeny stood watching. One by one, her children had left her and gone up north. Sam and Cleve to Ohio, Josie to Syracuse, Irene to Milwaukee. Now the man Miss Theeny had tried to keep Ida May from marrying in the first place was taking her away, too. Miss Theeny had no choice but to accept it and let Ida May and the grandchildren go for good. Miss Theeny drew them close to her, as she always did, whenever anyone was leaving. She had them bow their heads. She whispered a prayer that her daughter and her daughter's family be protected on the long journey ahead in the Jim Crow car. "May the Lord be the first one in the car," she prayed, "and the last out." When the time had come, Ida May and little James and Velma and all that they could carry were loaded into a brother-in-law's truck, and the 3 of them went to meet Ida May's husband at the train depot in Okolona for the night ride out of the bottomland. 2. Wildwood, Florida, April 14th, 1945. George Swanson Starling. A man named Roscoe Colton gave little George Starling a ride in his pickup truck to the train station in Wildwood through the fruit-bearing scrubland of central Florida. And Schoolboy, as the toothless orange pickers mockingly called him, boarded the Silver Meteor, pointing north. A railing divided the stairs onto the train, one side of the railing for white passengers, the other for colored, so the soles of their shoes would not touch the same stair. He boarded on the colored side of the railing, a final reminder from the place of his birth of the absurdity of the world he was leaving. He was getting out alive, so he didn't let it bother him. "I got on the car where they told me to get on," he said years later. He hadn't had time to bid farewell to everyone he wanted to. He stopped to say goodbye to Rachel Jackson, who owned a little cafe up on what they called the Avenue, and the few others he could safely get to in the little time he had. He figured everybody in Egypttown, the colored section of Eustis, probably knew he was leaving before he had climbed onto the train, small as the town was, and as much as people talked. It was a clear afternoon in the middle of April. He folded his tall frame into the hard surface of the seat, his knees knocking against the seat back in front of him. He was packed into the Jim Crow car, where the railroad stored the luggage, when the train pulled away at last. He was on the run, and he wouldn't rest easy until he was out of range of Lake County, beyond the reach of the grove owners whose invisible laws he had broken. The train rumbled past the forest of citrus trees that he had climbed since he was a boy, and that he had tried to wrestle some dignity out of, and for a time had. They could have their trees. He wasn't going to lose his life over them. He had come close enough as it was. He had lived up to his family's accidental surname, Starling, distant cousin to the Mockingbird. He had spoken up about what he had seen in the world he was born into, like the starling that sang Mozart's own music back to him, or the starling out of Shakespeare that tormented the king by speaking the name of Mortimer. Only George was paying the price for tormenting the ruling class that owned the citrus groves. There was no place in the Jim Crow South for a colored starling like him. He didn't know what he would do once he got to New York, or what his life would be. He didn't know how long it would take before he could send for Inez. His wife was mad right now, but she'd get over it once he got her there. At least that's what he told himself. He turned his face to the north and sat with his back to Florida. Leaving as he did, he figured he would never set foot in Eustis again for as long as he lived. And as he settled in for the 23-hour train ride up the coast of the Atlantic, he had no desire to have anything to do with the town he grew up in, the state of Florida, or the South as a whole, for that matter. 3. Monroe, Louisiana, Easter Monday, April 6, 1953. Robert Joseph Pershing Foster. In the dark hours of the morning, Pershing Foster packed his surgery books, his medical bag, and his suit and sport coats in the trunk, along with a map, an address book, and Ivory Covington's fried chicken left over from Saturday night. He said goodbye to his father, who had told him to follow his dreams. His father's dreams had fallen apart, but there was still hope for the son, the father knew. He had a reluctant embrace with his older brother Madison, who had tried in vain to get him to stay. Then Pershing pointed his 1949 Buick Roadmaster, a burgundy one with white wall tires and a shark-tooth grill, in the direction of Five Points, the crossroads of town. He drove down the narrow dirt roads with the ditches on either side that when he was a boy had left his freshly pressed Sunday suit caked with mud when it rained. He passed the shotgun houses perched on cinder blocks and hurtled over the railroad tracks away from where people who looked like him were consigned to live and into the section where the roads were not dirt ditches anymore but suddenly level and paved. He headed in the direction of Desaird Street, the main thoroughfare, and without a whiff of sentimentality, sped away from the small-town bank buildings and bail bondsmen, the Paramount Theater with its urine-scented steps, and away from St. Francis Hospital, which wouldn't let doctors who looked like him perform a simple tonsillectomy. Perhaps he might have stayed had they let him practice surgery like he was trained to do, or let him walk into the palace and try on a suit like anyone else of his station. The resentments had grown heavy over the years. He knew he was as smart as anybody else, smarter to his mind. But he wasn't allowed to do anything with it, the caste system being what it was. Now he was going about as far away as you could get from Monroe, Louisiana. The rope lines that had hemmed in his life seemed to loosen with each plodding mile on the odometer. Like many of the men in the Great Migration, and like many emigrant men in general, he was setting out alone. He would scout out the new world on his own and get situated before sending for anyone else. He drove west into the morning stillness and onto the Endham Bridge, a tight crossing with one lane acting like two that spans the Ouachita River into West Monroe. He would soon pass the mossback flatland of central Louisiana and the Red River toward Texas, where he was planning to see an old friend from medical school, a Dr. Anthony Beale, en route to California. Pershing had no idea where he would end up in California, or how he would make a go of it, or when he would be able to wrest his wife and daughters from the in-laws who had tried to talk him out of going to California in the first place. He would contemplate these uncertainties in the unbroken days ahead. From Louisiana, he followed the hyphens in the road that blurred together toward a faraway place, bridging unrelated things as hyphens do. Alone in the car, he had close to 2,000 miles of curving road in front of him, farther than farm worker emigrants leaving Guatemala for Texas, not to mention Tijuana for California, where a wind from the south could blow a Mexican clothesline over the border. In our homes, in our churches, wherever two or three are gathered, there is a discussion of what is best to do. Must we remain in the south or go elsewhere? Where can we go to feel that security which other people feel? Is it best to go in great numbers or only in several families? These and many other things are discussed over and over. A colored woman in Alabama, 1902. The Great Migration, 1915 to 1970. They fled as if under a spell or a high fever. They left as though they were fleeing some curse, wrote the scholar Emmett J. Scott. They were willing to make almost any sacrifice to obtain a railroad ticket, and they left with the intention of staying. From the early years of the 20th century to well past its middle age, nearly every black family in the American South, which meant nearly every black family in America, had a decision to make. There were sharecroppers losing at settlement, typists wanting to work in an office, yard boys scared that a single gesture near the planter's wife could leave them hanging from an oak tree. They were all stuck in a caste system as hard and unyielding as the red Georgia clay, and they each had a decision before them. In this, they were not unlike anyone who ever longed to cross the Atlantic or the Rio Grande. It was during the First World War that a silent pilgrimage took its first steps within the borders of this country. The fever rose without warning or notice, or much in the way of understanding by those outside its reach. It would not end until the 1970s, and would set into motion changes in the North and South that no one, not even the people doing the leaving, could have imagined at the start of it, or dreamed would take nearly a lifetime to play out. Historians would come to call it the Great Migration. It would become, perhaps, the biggest underreported story of the 20th century. It was vast. It was leaderless. It crept along so many thousands of currents over so long a stretch of time as to be difficult for the press truly to capture while it was underway. Over the course of 6 decades, some 6 million black Southerners left the land of their forefathers and fanned out across the country for an uncertain existence in nearly every other corner of America. The Great Migration would become a turning point in history. It would transform urban America and recast the social and political order of every city it touched. It would force the South to search its soul and finally to lay aside a feudal caste system. It grew out of the unmet promises made after the Civil War, and through the sheer weight of it, helped push the country toward the civil rights revolutions of the 1960s. During this time, a good portion of all black Americans alive picked up and left the tobacco farms of Virginia, the rice plantations of South Carolina, cotton fields in East Texas and Mississippi, and the villages and backwoods of the remaining southern states, Alabama, Arkansas, Florida, Georgia, Kentucky, Louisiana, North Carolina, Tennessee, and by some measures, Oklahoma. They set out for cities they had whispered of among themselves, or had seen in a mail-order catalog. Some came straight from the field, with their King James Bibles and old 12-string guitars. Still more were townspeople looking to be their fuller selves, tradesmen following their customers, pastors trailing their flocks. They would cross into alien lands with fast, new ways of speaking and carrying oneself, and with hard-to-figure rules and laws. The new world held out higher wages, but staggering rents, that the people had to calculate like a foreign currency. The places they went were big, frightening, and already crowded. New York, Detroit, Chicago, Los Angeles, Philadelphia, and smaller, equally foreign cities. Syracuse, Oakland, Milwaukee, Newark, Gary. Each turned into a receiving station and port of refuge, wrote the poet Carl Sandburg, then a Chicago newspaper reporter documenting the unfolding migration there. The people did not cross the turnstiles of customs at Ellis Island. They were already citizens. But where they came from, they were not treated as such. Their every step was controlled by the meticulous laws of Jim Crow, a 19th century minstrel figure that would become shorthand for the violently enforced codes of the Southern caste system. The Jim Crow regime persisted from the 1880s to the 1960s, some 80 years, the average lifespan of a fairly healthy man. It afflicted the lives of at least four generations and would not die without bloodshed, as the people who left the South foresaw. Over time, this mass relocation would come to dwarf the California Gold Rush of the 1850s with its 100,000 participants and the Dust Bowl migration of some 300,000 people from Oklahoma and Arkansas to California in the 1930s. But more remarkably, it was the first mass act of independence by a people who were in bondage in this country for far longer than they have been free. The story of the Great Migration is among the most dramatic and compelling in all chapters of American history, the Mississippi historian Neil McMillan wrote toward the end of the 20th century. So far-reaching are its effects, even now, that we scarcely understand its meaning. Its imprint is everywhere in urban life. The configuration of the cities as we know them, the social geography of black and white neighborhoods, the spread of the housing projects, as well as the rise of a well-scrubbed black middle class, along with the alternating waves of white flight and suburbanization, all of these grew directly or indirectly from the response of everyone touched by the Great Migration. So too rose the language and music of urban America that sprang from the blues that came with the migrants and dominates our airwaves to this day. So too came the people who might not have existed, or become who they did, had there been no Great Migration. People as diverse as James Baldwin and Michelle Obama, Miles Davis and Toni Morrison, Spike Lee and Denzel Washington, and anonymous teachers, store clerks, steelworkers and physicians were all products of the Great Migration. They were all children whose life chances were altered because a parent or grandparent had made the hard decision to leave. The Great Migration would not end until the 1970s, when the South began finally to change. The whites-only signs came down, the all-white schools opened up, and everyone could vote. By then, nearly half of all black Americans, some 47%, would be living outside the South, compared to 10% when the migration began. Oftentimes, just to go away, wrote John Dollard, a Yale scholar studying the South in the 1930s, is one of the most aggressive things that another person can do. And if the means of expressing discontent are limited, as in this case, it is one of the few ways in which pressure can be put. By the time it was over, no northern or western city would be the same. In Chicago alone, the black population rocketed from 44,103, just under 3% of the population, at the start of the migration, to more than 1 million at the end of it. By the turn of the 21st century, blacks made up a third of the city's residents, with more blacks living in Chicago than in the entire state of Mississippi. It was a folk movement of incalculable moment, McMillan said. And more than that, it was the first big step the nation's servant class ever took, without asking. The passenger train came wheezing through the North Georgia mountains after the colored school let out, and when it passed through the hill town of Rome, Georgia, back during the Depression, a little girl would run down the embankment and wait for it to rush past the locust trees. She would wave to the people in the metal boxes on wheels, the important people, their faces looking away, and dream of going wherever it was they were rushing to. Years later, she got on a train herself, heading north. The rail car was filled with the expectant faces of people hoping for all the rights and privileges of citizenship. She stepped off at Union Station in the border city of Washington, D.C. It was the start of the North, filled as it was with grand squares and circles named after northern heroes of the Civil War. Ulysses S. Grant, William Tecumseh Sherman, George Henry Thomas, David G. Farragut. Names to this day reviled in the South. She made her way to the address she had been given and settled onto the fold-out sofa in the front room of a second cousin she barely knew. Soon afterward, she performed a ritual of arrival that just about every migrant did, almost without thinking. She got her picture taken in the New World. It would prove that she had arrived. It was the migrant's version of a passport. The picture is sepia, 2 by 3 inches, from the 40s. Two young women sit on the front steps of a row house on R Street in Washington, looking very Betty Davis. Stacked heels and padded shoulders, wool coats brushing their knees. They are new in town. Childhood friends from Georgia, meeting up now in the big city. Their faces give no hint of whatever indignities the South had visited upon them. That was over now. Their faces are all smiles and optimism. The one in the pearls used to greet the train when she was little and dream of going with it. She would become a teacher, and years later, my mother. As a girl, I found the picture in a drawer in the living room, where many of those artifacts of migration likely ended up. I stared into the faces, searched the light in their eyes, the width of their smiles, for clues as to how they got there. Where did they go? What were they looking for? How did they get the courage to leave all they ever knew for a place they had never seen? The will to be more than the South said they had a right to be. Was it a braver thing to stay, or was it a braver thing to go? What would have happened if she had not gone north and met and married the Tuskegee airman from Virginia, a migrant himself, who would become my father? Would I and millions of other people born in the North and West have even existed? What would have happened had all those people raised under Jim Crow not spilled out of the South looking for something better? If they had not gone north, what would New York look like? What would Philadelphia, Detroit, Pittsburgh, Chicago, Los Angeles, Washington, and Oakland look like? What, for that matter, would the South look like? Would it have changed on its own? Or did the Black Exodus force the South to face itself in ways no one could ever have thought possible? What would have happened if I'd stayed? My mother asked out loud, repeating a question put to her one day. I don't even want to think about that. She never used the term Great Migration or any grand label for what she did, nor did she see her decision as having any meaning beyond herself. Yet she and millions of others like her were right in the middle of it. At one point, 10,000 were arriving every month in Chicago alone. It made for a spectacle at the railroad platforms, both north and south. I went to the station to see a friend who was leaving, Emmett J. Scott, an official at Tuskegee Institute in Alabama, wrote shortly after the migration began. I could not get in the station. There were so many people turning like bees in a hive. Those millions of people and what they did would seep into nearly every realm of American culture, into the words of Ralph Ellison and Toni Morrison, the plays of Lorraine Hansberry and August Wilson, the poetry and music of Langston Hughes and B.B. King, and the latter-day generation of Arrested Development and Tupac Shakur. It all but consumed the work of Richard Wright, the bard of the Great Migration. He gave voice to the fears and yearnings of his fellow migrants through his novel Native Son and his autobiography Black Boy. He had been a sharecropper's son in Natchez, Mississippi. He defected to the receiving station of Chicago, via Memphis, in December 1927, to feel, as he put it, the warmth of other suns. Yet for all of its influence, the migration was so vast that throughout history it has most often been consigned to the landscape, rarely the foreground. Scholars have devoted their attention to the earliest phase of the migration, the World War I era. Less has been written about the more massive sequence of migration that began during World War II, the historian James N. Gregory wrote in 2005. and a comprehensive treatment of the century-long story of black migration does not exist. This book addresses that omission. The stories in this book are based on the accounts of people who gave hundreds of hours of their days to share with me what was perhaps the singular turning point in their lives. They were among more than 1,200 people I interviewed for this book in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Milwaukee, and Oakland. All of them journeyed from the South during the Great Migration, and it is their collective stories that inform every aspect of this book. For the three main characters, Ida Mae Brandon Gladney, George Swanson Starling, and Robert Joseph Pershing Foster, and for others like them, the circumstances of their migrations shaped who they were and defined the course of their fortunes or misfortunes and the lives of their descendants. The events were thus easily recounted when the participants were called upon to do so. Official records corroborated those details that were indeed verifiable. But it is the larger emotional truths, the patient retelling of people's interior lives and motivations, that are the singular gift of the accounts in this book. With the passing of the earliest and succeeding generations of migrants, it is these stories that have become the least replaceable sources of any understanding of this great movement of people out of the South to the American North and West. This book covers a span of some 100 years. As the narrative moves through time, the language changes to retain the authenticity of each era. The word colored is used during the portion of the book in which that term was a primary identifier for black people, that is, during the first two-thirds of the 20th century, as evidenced by the colored high schools the people attended and the signage that directed them to segregated facilities. As the narrative moves into the 1960s, it shifts to the use of the term black after it gained popularity during the civil rights era, and then to both black and African American in the current era. Over time, the story of the Great Migration has suffered distortions that have miscast an entire population. From the moment the emigrants set foot in the North and West, they were blamed for the troubles of the cities they fled to. They were said to have brought family dysfunction with them, to more likely be out of work, unwed parents, and on welfare than the people already there. In the past 20 years, however, an altogether different picture has emerged from ongoing research by scholars of the Great Migration. Closer analysis of newly available census records has found that, contrary to conventional thought, black migrants were actually more likely to be married and to raise their children in two-parent households, and less likely to bear children out of wedlock. Compared with northern-born blacks, writes the sociologist Stuart E. Tolney, a leading expert on the migration, southern migrants had higher rates of participation in the labor force, lower levels of unemployment, higher incomes, lower levels of poverty and welfare dependency. The lives of the people in this book bear out this more complex understanding of the Great Migration, and based on the new data, represent the more common migrant experience than many previous accounts. Despite the overlapping of time and place in the text, the three main people in this narrative never met or knew one another. Their paths never crossed, except through their experiences with me, and metaphorically through the interlocking chapters of this book. The narrative portrays the phenomenon through people unknown to one another in the way that migrants moving along different currents would not have intersected, their anonymity a metaphor for the vast and isolating nature of the migration itself. The actions of the people in this book were both universal and distinctly American. Their migration was a response to an economic and social structure not of their making. They did what humans have done for centuries when life became untenable, what the Pilgrims did under the tyranny of British rule, what the Scotch-Irish did in Oklahoma when the land turned to dust, what the Irish did when there was nothing to eat, what the European Jews did during the spread of Nazism, what the landless in Russia, Italy, China, and elsewhere did when something better across the ocean called to them. What binds these stories together was the back against the wall, reluctant yet hopeful search for something better. Any place but where they were. They did what human beings looking for freedom throughout history have often done. They left. Part 2. Beginnings. This was the culture from which I sprang. This was the terror from which I fled. Richard Wright, Black Boy. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. Chicago, 1996. From the open door in the vestibule, I see her. She is sitting in a cotton house dress on a baby blue plastic-covered easy chair by the window. She is looking through a parting of the curtains at the street circus below. There they are, all scuffling beneath her. Urban drug dealers, falling down sweatpants, pooling at their feet, now bent over the driver's side window of a late-model sedan from the suburbs. Fourth graders doing lookout for men who could be their fathers. Young girls with their stomachs swelling already. Middle-aged men living out of their Pontiacs. Gangsters who might not make it to the weekend. She lives on the second floor of a three-flat on the south side of Chicago. She taps her foot and moves closer to the sill. This is not what she had come to Chicago for, nor was it what she expected it to be. But here she is, and this is what it has become, a place so dangerously absurd that it is living entertainment in her old age. She knows the street names and the code words for all the hustlers and pushers playing out their lives beneath her window. And even though they may have just shot a rival or just got out on parole, they look out for her and greet her kindly. You watch yourself now, Grandma. Because there is something sweet and kind about her. And she is from the old country and has survived a life of fear and privation they will never know. She has an endearing gap in her teeth, which go just about any which way they please. And her hair is now as soft and white as the cotton she used to pick, not particularly well, back in Mississippi. She is the color of sand on a beach, which she had heard of growing up, but had never seen for herself until she arrived in Chicago, half a lifetime ago. She has big, searching eyes that see the good in people, despite the evil she has seen. And she has a comforting kind of eternal beauty. Her skin, like the folds of a velvet shawl. Her name is Ida Mae, and she is a long way from where she started, back in the hard soil of the eastern foothills of Mississippi during the century's adolescence. She leans forward and adjusts herself for a long conversation. Her hazel eyes grow big as she begins to tell her story. Van Vliet, Mississippi, 1928. Ida Mae Brandon Gladney. It began, like many stories do, with a man. Actually, two men. They both came calling in the quiet hours of the hot season, when the cotton lay gestating in the field. Ida Mae had just sprouted into a woman of 15, and the suitors were out front, clutching their hats to their chests. They descended from opposite corners of old Chickasaw County, down the dirt roads that became mud rivers in the wet season and dust clouds in the dry, but were the only route to the bottom land by the Natchez Trace and an audience with Ida Mae, who was amused by it all. David McIntosh came after church on a tall red horse, the sun slanting heat through the hackberry trees, and he was always the first one there. He sat stiff in his Sunday clothes and sugar-talked the daughter in an old chair in the front room while her mother, Miss Theney, stood peeping by the door. When he had said all he had to say, which was never soon enough for Miss Theney, he climbed back on his horse and, as the daughter suspected, rode off to another girl he was weighing, named Sally. George Gladney walked 3 or 4 miles past the salt licks of Long Creek and over the railroad tracks to see Ida Mae. It took him longer than it took David McIntosh, and by the time he got there, his shirt was wet with perspiration and brown from the dust clouds stirred up on the road. Sometimes David's horse was still tied out front. George was a quiet, austere man, and felt a certain proprietorship toward Ida May. He waited for David to finish before going in himself. He stood outside and watched David mount his horse and gallop away before walking up the plank steps of the porch. Coming in second would give him more time to win the girl over and assess her fitness as a wife. Miss Theeny was not particular about either one of them. To begin with, they were too old for Ida May, trotting up the porch in their 20s when Ida May hadn't long turned 15. David was barely as tall as Ida May, and both of them were too dark by Miss Theeny's reckoning. She had little assurance of her daughter's upward mobility in a world where most colored women were sharecroppers' wives, but she could hope for the more favorable economic prospects of a lighter man, based on his acceptability to white people, and even kinship to them, maybe, which would be all the better. Ida May didn't go for that kind of talk and didn't pay it much attention. One color of wildflower was no better than another to her, so she made no distinctions whatsoever. She had a way of looking past the outer layer of people and seemed to regard everyone she met with a kind of searching intensity, as if this were the first person she had ever seen. In any case, Miss Theeny's protests were likely just an excuse. Whatever his attributes, Miss Theeny was not inclined to like any man that came courting her second girl. Miss Theeny gave birth to her in a little wood house on Cousin Irie's land and named her May Ida, after her husband's mother, Ida. It was March 5th, 1913, some 3 years after the start of the Great Migration that Ida May would unwittingly become a part of. There was a spark inside of her, and when she got big enough, she told people to call her Ida May instead of May Ida. She would later say it sounded less old-timey to her, but it was an early indication that she could think for herself when she chose to. She was a small-framed girl with a chiseled face the color of nut butter and her dark brown hair in plaits most of the time. It turned out she was fearless and spirited and liked doing the kinds of things men are known for doing. She was no good in the field, but she could chop wood and kill snakes and didn't mind doing it, and that was a good thing for Miss Theeny. By the time men started showing up on the porch for Ida May, Miss Theeny was a widow, left to tend the land they lived on all by herself. She stood eye to eye with most men and suffered no fools, but she had little help now. Her oldest daughter, Irene, had gone off and gotten married. Her two grown sons, Sam and Cleve, had fled north to Ohio, like more and more colored boys chafing in the South seemed to be doing. Her husband, Joseph, had just about run them off before he died. Joseph would beat them for any little thing, since they weren't his blood like the girls were. And that didn't make them want to stay, either. So they went up north. That left Miss Theeny with her youngest daughters, Josephine, who was able to work but wouldn't, and Talma, who was too young to work, and her second, the tomboy, Ida May. On her way home from school, Ida May climbed up the hickory and walnut trees on the side of the road and shook them down. She picked the skittle bumps off the ground and cracked them on her teeth. She saw how her brothers relieved themselves in the woods at the side of a tree and tried it herself. Being a girl, it didn't work as well when she tried it standing up. Sam and Cleve, before they'd left, had to shoo her away when they went out hunting rabbit. She crouched behind the trees, and they heard her rustling near them, and threw tap sticks at her, the sticks they took to kill the rabbits with. Sometimes she spotted a rabbit sleeping and popped it with a tap stick, and along with whatever her brothers took in, they would eat well that night. Sometimes her brothers didn't want to be bothered, so they gave her a quarter and let her plow in their place so they could go to a pickup baseball game. She'd get behind the mule and go up and down the field, cutting lines in the earth as if it were the most important job in the world. The kids started calling her Tom because she acted more like a boy. They lived on the curving land in the hill country of northeast Mississippi. It was a voluptuous place, more beautiful than the delta land along the Great River, and like anything beautiful, had a tendency to break grown people's hearts. It was not meant to work as hard as it was made to when it came to sewing cotton, and of the two regions, it had the more difficult birthing pains. Joseph Brandon had come into ownership of a piece of bottom land where he planted cotton and grew hogs. The land that colored men managed to get was usually scratch land nobody wanted. Still, he courted the land every spring. He cut lines in the earth with an old till, a swayback mule, and a horse named Jim. He planted cottonseed in the topsoil and tried to conjure rain. When the land turned green, he chopped the unwanted leaves that got in the way of the buds trying to grow. By late summer, if the rains had come but not rotted the seed, if the sun had burned long enough by day and the dew had descended by night, dry snow sprang from the earth at the tips of low scrub that came to bud with his prayers and sweat. The land would be salted with white confetti that spread out to the tree line. Then he had to bend down in the beating sun to pick the bowls and crouch and crawl to reach the lowest buds. Before she was big enough to see over the cotton, Ida May followed her father out to the field. He gave her a flour sack to keep her occupied, and she tagged behind him and gathered cotton bowls, even though what little she brought in was not of much use. It turned out she had no talent whatsoever for the field and didn't like the chore of picking. But her father was always out there, and picking gave her time with him. "That's how come I know about the field," she would say half a life later. "Wherever he went, I went." When he wasn't nursing the cotton, he was tending the hogs. Sometimes the hogs ran off and got stuck in the creek water, swollen up after the gully washers that poured from the sky in the spring. Ida May followed her father down to the creek and watched him slosh in the water to save his drowning hogs. The rains brought moccasin snakes to the surface and left them alive on the creek bank when the water fell back. Ida May took sticks to pick them up with and played with them like toys. The rains beat down on Mississippi in May of 1923. The hogs went down to the creek and got stuck like they always did. But when her father slogged in after them, he had trouble bringing them in for all the flood water that had risen up. He got sick from exposure and never recovered. He was 43 years old. He was diabetic, and the grown people said he was dead. But Ida May sat at the side of his bed and touched him, and he was warm. No doctor ever tended to him. There were no colored doctors around. The white ones were all in town, and the family would have had to meet them halfway, if they were going to see them at all, because the doctors in town didn't know the backwoods. Even if they had been inclined to come, the roads were too muddy from the rains to get through. Ida May thought the grown people should give him more time. Maybe he would come out of the spell he was in. Years later, she learned that educated people had a name for what her father appeared to be in. They called it a coma. But in that world and in that time, nobody could know for sure, and nobody would pay a little girl any attention, and so they set the date for the burial. She and her sisters Irene and Josie and Thelma didn't have any shoes, and went trailing behind their mother in their bare feet to the funeral. Nobody felt sorry for them, because most other people didn't have shoes either. When they closed the casket, Ida May thought for sure that her father was alive in there. "I still say today he wasn't dead," she would say 3/4 of a century later. At that time, they didn't have a way to know. Not long after the funeral, Ida May was sitting on the bin where they stored the hay and corn in an enclosure they called a crib. She looked up and saw what looked to be her father walk in. It was both startling and natural. He reached his hand out to her and took her hand in his and held it. When she realized what was happening, she ran out screaming and went to get Miss Thiney. "Daddy's in the crib," she cried. "I saw him." "Girl, get away from me with that lying," Miss Thiney said. "Joseph wouldn't scare you." I held his hand just as plain as day, Ida May said. She never saw him again. As the summer wore on, it sank in that he wasn't coming back, and she started resenting the world and the people who had fathers. She started fighting and picking fights with people for no reason. School was out because colored children only went to school when they were not needed in the field. Ida May and other colored children in rural Mississippi didn't start school until the cotton was picked, which meant October or November, and they stopped going to school when it was time to plant in April. 6 months of school was a good year. She was still grieving when it came time to go back the next fall. She walked a mile of dirt road past the drying cotton and the hackberry trees to get to the one-room schoolhouse that one way or the other had to suffice for every colored child from first to eighth grade, the highest you could go back then, if you were colored, in Chickasaw County. The children formed a walking train to get there. It started with the child farthest away and picked up more children as it moved in the direction of the schoolhouse, until just about the whole school was in a cluster at the front door. Ida May was easily distracted by the nut trees along the way and had a hard time keeping up. "I be lagging behind, hollering and crying, 'cause they run off and leave me," she said. When the rains came and the water got too high for the children to pass through the hog wallows in places like where Ida May lived, the old people cut down a tree and trimmed the limbs so the children could cross over the log to get to school. The school was a narrow-frame cabin with wood benches and long windows, run by a teacher who was missing a leg. Amos Kirks was a source of unending curiosity and whispers among the children. He was of an age where he might have lost his leg in World War I, but none of the children knew for sure. He walked into the schoolroom, hobbling on crutches, in a suit with a stern face. He rotated the grades as if the room were a railroad switchyard, calling the second and third graders to the front when it was their turn, while the other children moved to the back to do their lessons. He towered above them and always wore a tie. But all the children could see was the left pant leg pinned up at the knee and air where a calf and foot should have been. One day Mr. Kirks came in, and his pant leg wasn't pinned at the knee. He had a new leg, but he couldn't walk on it like a real one. "He throwed the leg like it was tiresome to him," Ida May said, "and it would swing. He kind of swing it around." It was the talk of the schoolyard. "He finally got him a leg," the children whispered to each other. When Mr. Kirks wasn't looking, Ida May tried to tug at his pant cuff. "I sat side of him," Ida May said years later. "I try to do all I know how to get up under there and see how that leg looked. I sat by him, and I just rub and do. He couldn't feel it no way, and I could see the clear foot in the shoe." Ida May had to make sure Mr. Kirks didn't catch on. For the slightest infraction, Mr. Kirks would send some boys out to the woods to get branches off a tree. Then the child who was talking out of turn or drawing when he should have been listening was called up front for lashings with the switch. Ida May knew how that felt. In the fall after her father died, they were in the middle of a spelling lesson. One of the words was a city in the north called Philadelphia. Mr. Kirks called on Ida May to spell it. Some words the children turned into jingles to help them remember. For geography, it was "George eat o' gray rat at poor house yesterday." For Mississippi, it was "M-I crooked letter, I crooked letter, I humpback, I." Ida May had heard about the North, but didn't know Philadelphia or any ditties for it. She stumbled over the word. Mr. Kirks thought she was acting up. He told some boys to go out to the woods and get him a switch. He held the branches over the fire and told Ida May to come up front. He told her to bend over. He drew his arm back, and in front of all the other children, he whipped her. And each time the switch snapped her back, He shouted a letter. P-H-I-L-A-D-E-L-P-H-I-A. She was hurt to be singled out that day. She wasn't saying she hadn't done a devilish thing in her life. She was just thinking to herself all she had done was miss the word, and the whipping wasn't called for. After school, she went up to Mr. Kirk's and told him so. "If I had a daddy, you wouldn't have whooped me," Ida May told him. "You whooped me 'cause I don't have a daddy." He never whipped her again. She seemed to be more aware of how life was harder now. Things she wouldn't have paid attention to before, she seemed to be noticing. On her way to and from school, she passed the farm of a man named Mr. Bafford. His wife had left him to raise their son by himself, and he seemed to take out his grief on those around him. He had a yard full of trees that bore more fruit than he could ever consume or pick fast enough to sell. The peaches and apples and pears were some of the biggest and sweetest in the bottoms. They ripened and fell to the ground, and still he dared anyone to come onto his land to get any. Ida May figured out a way to get some. She stopped by and talked with Mr. Bafford, and made sure to keep him talking. And if he ever looked away, she reached down and slipped a pear or an apple into her dress. "You know they fall off. He could have give us some of them," she said. "Every time I got a chance, I got me some." It was approaching Christmas, the first Christmas since her father had died. One day when Ida May stopped to see Mr. Bafford, she started wondering aloud whether Santa Claus was going to come this year, what with her daddy gone and all.
"That's the first thing they teach y'all, a lie," Mr. Bafford said. "Ain't no such thing as Santa Claus."
It crushed Ida May to hear him say that. She was 10, and even in the gaunt world she lived in, she still believed in Santa Claus. She started crying when Mr. Bafford said it.
"That taken all the joy out of life then," she said.
There would be no Christmas that year.
"I'm not able to pay Santa Claus to come to us," Miss Thiney told the girls.
Ida May began to resent everybody now. She was getting into more scrapes coming and going to school, and getting ornery without cause. A boy named Henry Lee Babbitt used to ride his horse to school every day and brought corn to feed him with. Ida May lived farther than Henry Lee did and had to walk. Something got into Ida May one day, and she told Henry Lee she was going to set his horse loose. She went up to the horse and reached for the bridle bit that tied the horse to the hitching post.
"Tom, you bet not turn my horse a-loose," Henry Lee said.
"What if I do?" Ida May shot back.
"You do, I beat your brains out."
The two of them stood there next to the horse, Ida May holding the bridle bit and threatening to pull it off, and Henry Lee trying to keep her from doing it.
"I D-double-dog dare you to pull that bridle," Henry Lee said. "You take that there, and you take a nickel off a dead man's eye."
She yanked the bridle off the horse and dropped it to the ground.
"And down the road we went, me and the boy there fighting," she said years later.
Henry Lee reached down and grabbed the bridle bit from where she left it and raised it up against her.
"He took it and nearly beat me to death," she said. "I got a knot in back of my head now where he hit me with that bridle bit."
Without her half-brothers and her father around, she was on her own.
"You had to fight," she would later say. "Them boys would mess with you. You couldn't whoop 'em, but you did what you could."
Within a few years, the boys would not want to fight with her anymore. They wanted to sit and hold her hand and talk. The spark that made her fight them drew the quiet ones to her when it came time for courting. She was 15 when two in particular started showing up at the front porch with those intentions. On a Sunday, after service in the summer of 1928, the church mothers at New Hope Baptist set out the hot platters of corn.